A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Dwight Eisenhower, good president, great president, people liked him. I like Ike, right? The expression, I like Ike. Moved 1.5 million illegal immigrants out of this country. Moved them just beyond the border, they came back. Moved them again beyond the border, they came back. Didn't like it. Moved them way south, they never came back. Dwight Eisenhower. You don't get nicer, you don't get friendlier. They moved 1.5 million people out. We have no choice.
That's candidate Trump speaking last November about a mass deportation of Mexican immigrants in the 1950s. It was known as Operation Wetback. We'll take a look back at what happened then and what it says about today. But first, Donald Trump has promised to rescind Obama's executive order called DACA. That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program that gives temporary legal status to so-called Dreamers, undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. as kids. The order has made it possible for Dreamers to work legally and get out from under the fear of deportation. Almost 750,000 have registered with the program. More than a quarter of them live in L.A. County. But what will happen to them if Trump makes good on his threat? Joining me now is a Dreamer who came to the U.S. from Korea when she was 13. She prefers that we not use her real name, so we'll call her Sylvia. Also here is Judy London, directing attorney of the Immigrants' Rights Project at Public Counsel. That's a pro bono law firm here in L.A. And welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
And Sylvia, let me start with you. How did you first come to the U.S.?
Hi. I came to the United States when I was 13 years old with a visiting visa. It was a six-month visa, and my visa has expired, and I was enrolled in public middle school.
And what were your circumstances? I understand you were living with your grandmother and others?
Right, right. My circumstances was that my family is divided in half, or half of my mother's side family has a citizenship here, and then I was just had an opportunity to work. It sounded like I had an opportunity to come here as to study in the United States.
And you went to San Jose State, right? Graduated?
Yes, I did. Yes, I graduated.
So what has DACA meant for you in your life?
DACA has been really beneficial for me in a way that it helps for me to do very essential things that I can live and survive in the United States, which is providing me the Social Security number. And I was able to really pursue my dream to work in the animation industry and open up my savings account, bank account, health insurance, and proper ID identification card that I can prove my identity when it was asked and questioned to. For the first time, I was able to pay taxes, and it was really felt good about doing so.
And I understand when you registered, you were an unpaid intern at an animation studio, and then afterwards,
yes,
you got paid full-time job?
Yes.
In the studio?
Entire my life, I was working under the table. I was, server at the restaurant for like 5 years. I did a lot of domestic jobs, which doesn't require for me to show my papers. But basically, DACA helped me to pursue what I always wanted to do, and it protected me to do the legal way.
So what are you concerned about? What will happen when Donald Trump becomes president?
I mean, I think I can share the similar fear that we all live under DACA. We don't know anything that's going to happen in January. I mean, a lot of us live a daily life like in fear and also be vigilant about it at the same time. But we really don't know what's going to happen to us. We are very angry. Some of us actively protest and that, but a lot of us also feel really scared. I've had nightmares a couple of weeks, and it's been really hard to concentrate and do a daily task.
I bet. Yeah. Let's turn to Judy London at Public Counsel. What kind of calls have you been getting from dreamers, and are you hearing about stories like this about nightmares?
We are getting an awful lot of calls, and people are extremely frightened, and we're really trying to address that by giving people information about their rights and reducing the panic. The truth is that we're getting more calls from people who are U.S. citizens, but because they may look like an immigrant or look Latino or are Latino, their children are coming home from school in tears, thinking that their mother or father is going to be deported simply based on the way they look. So we're getting more calls from people who have nothing to do with the dreamer situation than the dreamers. But, of course, we fought for the rights for dreamers for a decade. And DACA beneficiaries are our students, our colleagues. We have DACA beneficiaries on our staff. And so we stand in solidarity with the DACA community, and advocates across the state and across the nation are going to do everything we can if President Trump does try to make good on his promise to eliminate the DACA program.
And let's talk about that promise in real terms, in practical terms. What would it mean for dreamers like Sylvia, who signed up for the program?
Well, we're all trying to predict, and as your listeners know, predictions have not been that accurate this election season. But if he discontinued it, it could be challenged in court. He could discontinue the program, but work permits could still be valid until their expiration date. So someone who had just been issued a work permit may still have a year left on that work permit, or he could try to essentially nullify those work permits. And again, those of us on the front lines are looking at challenges to that. But the greatest concern is not that dreamers will be rounded up. The greatest concern is that these young people, who are the backbone of our economy and our future, will lose the ability to pursue their dreams. For most, it means financing college. For others, it means becoming doctors or teachers or lawyers. The majority are studying, and we want to make sure they stay in school and have alternative means, if necessary, to generate income to be studying.
Well, as you say, we don't exactly know what will happen, but President-elect Trump has said that he intends to follow through on his pledge to deport 2 million, it could be possibly 3 million people. I wonder, Sylvia, what does your family think about your situation?
It has really not been big on, I don't think they quite understand the what situation I'm in. I just don't think, to be quite frankly, I think for a lot of Asian American families, they are not aware of DACA program, or, you know, they don't really understand what's going to happen. We live in under fear because a lot of Latino communities and other communities really come together and try to make this go through together, but a lot of Asian Americans I think do fear. There are a lot of I've attended the convention with the United Dreamers, United We Dream, last May, and I have met a couple social activists who are Asian American backgrounds, but I think a lot of parents' generation and Asian Americans are not aware of things, that what could possibly happen to us. And that's where my family is. I don't think they really quite fully understand what could mean this for me and, you know, my brother or any other people like us.
And turning back to you, Judy, just in terms of those numbers, 2 million, 3 million people, President-elect Trump did seem to indicate that they would focus on people with criminal backgrounds. What does that mean for dreamers who have been registered, they've been vetted, they don't fit the bill, they've been vetted for criminal backgrounds?
Well, again, we don't anticipate that he'll use the information that dreamers provided when they applied for DACA. There's a lengthy application form, so you're right, the government has that information. We do not think that President Trump will use that to initiate enforcement, because he has stated that his enforcement priority is for people with criminal histories. Of course, his vision of who's a criminal, may end up not making any sense and end up including a vastly greater pool of people than those with any kind of serious criminal conviction. But nevertheless, you would not have been granted DACA if you had any serious crimes. And so we do not, again, think that the Dreamer community is going to be targeted. But again, there's a reason for concern. This is uncharted territory. But again, we really do want to reduce the fear and make sure that Dreamers continue to tell their stories and exercise their First Amendment rights and make known their contributions, which are important. So we've seen in the last couple years how much progress has been made when people felt that they could come out of the shadows. And I think that in California, knowing that our state legislators are solidly behind the Dream community is going to help people feel that they do not have to disappear again and be under the radar. But yes, the immediate urgent problem will be for those relying on income from jobs, particularly those that need to pay college tuition, how are they going to keep the income coming in?
Judy London, she's directing attorney of the Immigrants' Rights Project at Public Counsel. Thank you very much for this. And thank you, Sylvia. Sylvia's a Dreamer and lives here in Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Well, as Donald Trump talks about his plans for a mass deportation of undocumented workers, we wanted to look back at the last mass deportation in American history. President Dwight D. Eisenhower deported more than 1 million undocumented immigrants in 1954. He called it the Special Forces Mobile Operation, but the INS and the media referred to it as Operation Wetback. And the vast majority of the deportees lived in Texas and California. Here to explain how Operation Wetback worked and the effects it had on the country is Natasha Iskander. She's Associate Professor of Public Policy at New York University. She does research on migration and economic development and is focused on Mexican migrants in the U.S. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Barbara.
I've got to say that name, I stumbled over it, I think, every time. Ugh, this was 1954, but I'm assuming that the term wetback was still very much a pejorative, right?
In 1954, it certainly was, but there wasn't such a strong sentiment against using pejorative terms to characterize Mexican immigrants.
Well, what was the mood in the nation at that time? Remind us, because we've been seeing this intense anti-immigrant feeling from parts of the right in recent years, and certainly during this election. Is that what was happening in 1954 as well?
The mood in the country in 1954 was one of pretty significant paranoia against communists. We were in the midst of our Red Scare, and we were also in a moment of transition, not unlike the moment we're living through now, where the racial politics as pertains to immigration were changing. So in 1952, we rescinded the component of our immigration law that required citizens to be white. And so this was in part a reaction to that change.
So this was a time of upheaval. I mean, that I would imagine if you rescind the idea that immigrants had to be white, then anyone who was non-white was suspect.
Yes, in some sense, the idea was that how could we reestablish, this was obviously not an idea that was said explicitly, but how can we reestablish the notion that citizenship is associated with whiteness? The operational mandate for Operation Wetback was different. Basically, the federal government was concerned that the growers who were using Mexican migrants in the Southwest were bypassing its guest worker program, which was called the Bracero Program. The Bracero Program referred to a series of laws and agreements with the Mexican government about the importation of Mexican workers to work on U.S. farms. And most farmers were bypassing the Bracero program because it had certain requirements for wages, accommodation, food, etc. And farmers also viewed it as very bureaucratic. It was much easier for them to employ undocumented immigrants. And in part, the federal government was launching Operation Wetback to compel growers to re-enter the fold of this program.
Ah, now, if you were a deportee in 1954, then what happened to you? Did you just get shoved into a truck?
If you were deported during Operation Wetback, you were likely put on a bus or on a train or on a boat and shipped to central Mexico. The conditions on all of those modes of transport were abysmal. And when you were rounded up, you were rounded up without the ability to notify your family. You were shipped to a part of Mexico you likely did not know and had never been to. And you had to figure out how to earn a livelihood or cope with a new setting that you did not know. Just like deportation programs today, families were ripped apart, communities were torn asunder. There was a very poignant climate of fear that accompanied Operation Wetback.
What legal recourse did anyone have under the... None. You couldn't just show your papers or your...
No, actually, one of the things about Operation Wetback that may be really important to note is that many Mexican Americans, citizens who had migrated legally or who were born in the U.S., were actually deported also. And the typical paperwork that demonstrated citizenship and a legal right to be in the country, like draft cards, social security cards, were often rejected. And immigration service agents requested things like birth certificates, which people don't carry on their person. One of the reasons that Operation Wetback created such enormous fear in Latino communities around the U.S. is that your immigration status didn't really matter. What didn't really inform who was going to get deported or not. What mattered was whether you appeared to the immigration service as Latino and undocumented.
Well, what role did the media play then in Operation Wetback? And it's interesting that you've written it was as close to Trump's preferred medium of reality television as was possible in the 1950s. How did the press corps cover this?
So the press corps was embedded in many of the teams of immigration agents who raided hotels and foundries and factories and farms. And they published a series of stories documenting the heroics of these immigration agents who were rounding up undocumented immigrants and putting them in holding pens in city parks or searching their bodies and belongings, having them stand in the hot sun or marching them as captives through cities in California.
So basically PR for the program.
It was definitely PR. In fact, Operation Wetback was not very successful as a deportation operation. Most historical accounts put the number far, far below what the government touted. And its main success was to use the media to create a climate of fear and to send a very strong message that the U.S. government was going to crack down on this criminal invasion of undocumented immigrants into the country. And that citizenship was going to be associated with whiteness.
So what effect did both the campaign of fear and the actual mass deportations have on businesses in the U.S. and on the farms with so many people being deported, but also, I imagine, so many people hiding out for fear of being deported?
So the consequences for farms and businesses were different. The farms were encouraged to come back into the fold of the Bracero program. There were a series of backroom deals between the Immigration Service and farmers, encouraging them to renew their participation in the guest worker program, and they actually, in the parlance of the time, dried out their wetbacks. In other words, they moved their undocumented immigrants onto the formal employment rolls. So they were not substantially affected in terms of their operations. The people or the businesses that were businesses in cities, factories, foundries, hotels, restaurants. Their workers hid out during Operation Wetback, and newspaper reports from the time recount just how serious a blow this operation was on their businesses.
Well, now Trump takes office next year, and he mentioned his admiration for Eisenhower and Eisenhower's deportation policy during the debates. And he has an immigration hardliner, Kris Kobach, working on this policy. So how much do you imagine a Trump administration can realistically borrow from this historical example?
He doesn't have to be very effective in terms of mounting a deportation force to create a pervasive and damaging climate of fear. We can imagine homemade videos of people being deported appearing on YouTube, on our Twitter feeds, and having our children and members of our community watch these videos. This is a way of reestablishing the notion that citizenship is predicated on whiteness.
Natasha Iskander, she's Associate Professor of Public Policy at New York University, and I really appreciate you talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for having me.
What are your concerns about Trump's immigration plans? Are you a dreamer? Are your friends or family members afraid they'll be deported? Call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, repeal or replace. That's the perennial Republican call to action on Obamacare. But President-elect Trump and the party has been vague on the details. Now some plans are emerging. We get a rundown. That's next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bokave in for Madeline Brand. Repeal and replace. That's been the Republican Party's mantra when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Now that the GOP will control the White House and both chambers of Congress, the party has a chance to make good on its promise. But what do its replacement plans for Obamacare, which has helped around 22 million people get health coverage, what do they look like? Joining us to break down some of the proposals is Sarah Cliff. She covers healthcare for Vox.com, and it's good to talk with you.
Yeah, great to talk with you.
Well, the going concern throughout the debate over health care was that Republicans didn't seem to have a replacement policy. And now I read in your story that they have seven plans.
So there are a lot of plans floating out there. I think they went a little bit unnoticed because Obamacare repeal seemed so impossible up until about a week ago, up until the election. They are not fully fleshed out. You know, we're talking, these are white papers, policy documents. Most of them are not actual legislative language, so they do leave out a lot of details, but they definitely have a base of ideas to work from, and we kind of have an outline of the type of ideas that Republicans will consider for a replacement plan.
Right. And what is that outline, or what are the common themes that you find among these plans?
Yeah, so there's a few that stood out at me reading over seven of them over the past week. One of them is that they would definitely reduce coverage from the levels we have right now because of Obamacare. It would not go back to as low as it was before the law passed. So the Republican plans, they're definitely an improvement on where we were when Obamacare passed, but they would leave some number of people without coverage. And in terms of who those people are, the Republican plans tend to benefit healthy younger people, and they tend to leave off people who are sicker and people who are older.
Right. And why don't you tell us about the front runners among the seven, which among these plans are most likely to shape how the Republicans are going to approach replacing Obamacare, and who's backing
them? The definite front runner would be the plan from House Speaker Paul Ryan, just because he's in a position of power. He put this plan out last summer.
Right.
It's definitely missing a lot of details. But
this is Better Way, he calls
this
it.
This is the Better Way plan from Paul Ryan. And then we also have a plan that came out of the Senate Finance Committee called the Patient Care Act. It's been around a little bit longer. It's much shorter. It's less detailed. So those are two of the ones I look at as the starting points for the debate. And then we have a few plans from think tanks, a few plans from less prominent legislators that are also in the mix. But I think those two will be the framework for the debate, and then you might see some pulling of ideas from other plans.
And let's look at Paul Ryan's Better Way. What's the big difference between Ryan's plan and Obamacare?
So there's a lot of differences, a lot of space between the two of them. Depending on which economic analysis you look at, they would either leave 4 or 9 million people without insurance. So either way, we're looking at a drop in insurance. Obamacare would cover more people than Better Way. one of the big differences that stands out to me is right now Obamacare gives the poorest people the most generous incomes. It says the most generous subsidies for insurance, excuse me. It says that you don't have a high income, we will make your insurance as cheap as possible. The Ryan plan does not do that. It gives everyone the same insurance subsidy, the same insurance tax credit, regardless of how much they earn. So poverty advocates are quite worried about the Ryan plan because it would change who we give help to and how much help we give to low-income Americans.
And there's also this really big modification concerning continuous care, that requirement. Explain
yes,
that for us, because that's a little confusing.
Yeah, it definitely is confusing. So as is no surprise to anyone listening, Republicans hate the individual mandate. They want to get rid of the requirement that everyone have health insurance, but they need some other policy to get people to join the market, or else they're just going to end up with a bunch of sick people and high premiums. So the policy they seem to have settled on is called continuous coverage, where they say that you cannot be underwritten. We will not charge sick people more as long as they maintain continuous coverage, as long as they have no break in their health insurance. So as long as you, let's say you leave a job, you go straight to the individual market, you're fine. But you end up not fine if you have any break in coverage, if you forget to enroll, if you can't afford to enroll. In that case, let's say you're a cancer patient who had a break in coverage for a few months, you go to an insurance company, they can charge you whatever they want to charge you. They can charge you as much as they want. They have to offer you a plan, but there's nothing that stops them from charging you $1,000 to $3,000.
Right. And this so is the provision that would directly affect people with pre-existing conditions.
It would. So I think when Donald Trump says he wants to ban pre-existing conditions, we should be asked some questions about what that actually means. It can be true that under the Ryan plan, insurance companies have to offer coverage to everyone, regardless of pre-existing conditions, but they can also, in these situations I described, charge people with pre-existing conditions a lot more money. And, you know, if you have an offer of coverage you can't afford, I think there's a question of, you know, whether that's worthwhile or not.
And just briefly, Senator Orrin Hatch's plan?
It's pretty similar. So one of the it has this continuous coverage provision. One of the surprises I found in that plan is it tries to get people into coverage by enrolling people who don't pick anything into a default plan, which it surprised me because Republicans have generally been very anti-big government, anti-government intrusion, yet they have the surprising feature of their plan where if you're someone who's uninsured and you don't pick a plan, your state will actually default you into a very cheap option. So that was somewhat surprising and I think could be a flashpoint in the debate we're about to see.
And both of these plans also call for changes to employer-based insurance plans. Tell us about that.
They do, and this could be a huge fight. Right now, employer-sponsored insurance in the United States is exempt from taxes, and they want to limit that tax exemption. We don't have a ton of details on where it would get limited. Most of them don't want to get rid of it entirely, but they want to cap it at some dollar amount, at some percentile. And this would be a big increase in premium prices for people with employer-sponsored insurance. It's an idea economists love. They think that the tax preferences we have for insurance right now give an incentive for employers to provide too much insurance for us to really use a lot of healthcare that we might not need. But you can bet that the 150 million people who get insurance through their employers would not be thrilled if all of a sudden their premiums are going up because the tax preference has been reduced.
Sarah Cliff, she covers healthcare for Vox.com. And thank you so much for this fly through of all the plans.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Well, we'd like to hear from you. What are your concerns about Obamacare moving forward? Call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. And coming up, Colson Whitehead. He just won the National Book Award for fiction for his novel, The Underground Railroad.
Once I decided to make a real railroad, I was freed up to create my own sort of take on American history, not sticking to the facts of what happened, but sticking to the truth.
A conversation with Colson Whitehead next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Colson Whitehead took home the prestigious National Book Award for fiction last night. He won it for his novel, The Underground Railroad. In his acceptance speech, he talked about the election of Donald Trump.
I hit upon something that was making me feel better, and I guess it was, I think, hopefully applicable to other folks. You know, be kind to everybody, make art, and fight the power.
The novel follows a teenage slave named Cora to a hard-won freedom. She starts her journey on a plantation in Georgia and then escapes via an actual underground railroad. Madeline Brand spoke with Colson Whitehead about its book earlier this year.
When you're a kid and you first hear about the Underground Railroad, the words are so evocative, you imagine an actual subway tunnel beneath America, which is not incredibly practical. And it seemed just as, when I was older, an interesting notion to play around with. What if it actually existed? So that was the premise. And as I developed the story, I thought, well, what if every state that Cora goes through is a different state of American possibility? So South Carolina has its own culture. North Carolina is a different kind of take on America, an alternative America. So I started with that. Obviously, if you're dealing with someone escaping from slavery, and it's an adventure tale, you're being pursued by bounty hunters, the government. And so pretty quickly it became a story, you know, it's a story of adventure, survival, and trying to make it to that safe haven that you imagine exists in the North.
Yeah. So in South Carolina, a lot of bad stuff happens. She initially thinks this is a great place, a safe haven. She's allowed to walk freely, and she hasn't been able to do that, obviously, on a plantation. And so she and the man that she escapes with, they decide, well, we're gonna stop here and see if we can make a go of it. And then it becomes clear that bad things are happening. Women are being sterilized, men are being injected with syphilis. And so these are things that did happen in our history, but you put it all together in one story. And why did you decide to do that? Because it feels a little bit like, I don't know, magical realism a little bit by conflating all these historical events.
You know, once I decided to make a real railroad, I was freed up to change things around and play with time more, bringing in the Holocaust, the lynching culture of the late 19th century, and move things around in order to create my own sort of take on American history. I'm not sticking to the facts of what happened, but sticking to the truth. And so once I was not bound to the guidebook of historical fiction writers of America, I was able to explore different parts of American history in a way that I couldn't if I was sticking to the facts.
Mm. Did you have to do a lot of research?
Daunting research, yeah. I mean, doing a deep dive into slavery is harrowing and terrifying. There are various points where I was writing this or that particular atrocity. For example, the lynching scenes in North Carolina, where the people in the town all gather on Friday to lynch black people who they've captured. And in writing it, you know, I was thinking, have I gone too far? Is this too over the top? But I could always go to research and be sadly reassured that I wasn't. You know, lynchings were public entertainment. You would string up or burn alive the black person you had scapegoated in the town square, and hundreds of people would gather. You'd take pictures, bring your kids. One of the earliest forms of postcards were lynching postcards, where you would show a picture of someone strung up and then send it to your relative in another state and say, you know, wish you were here, had a great time at this lynching. So all the stuff that I thought up in the book couldn't really compete with the sadistic imaginations of slave masters. Mm-hmm. It's a wonder that anyone survived, let alone had the courage to escape north, when if you ran from the Deep South, the penalty was death for running away. So most of my research came from slave narratives. There are the famous ones, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Jacobs, and then the ones collected by the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s when they interviewed people who are teenagers and kids at the time of the Civil War. There were hundreds and hundreds of brief narratives of their lives, and some are very quotidian, just about farming, and some are longer explorations of slave life. And it, you know, gave me the grounding to create my own plantation.
Hmm. Was there someone that you had read about that you based Cora on?
Harriet Jacobs, you know, who I just mentioned, spent 7 years in an attic after she ran away from her master, waiting for safe passage out of North Carolina. That informed the North Carolina chapter in this book. My protagonist, Cora, is trapped in an attic and waiting for the Underground Railroad to pick her up. But definitely the research informs, hopefully, the reality of the 1850 world I'm creating and playing with. But there's no strict model for different characters.
And I'm wondering how much present-day events have shaped your novel, and how, in particular, perhaps the Black Lives Matter movement figured into the writing of this novel and the things that are going on politically now in America.
I guess the fact that we have a severe police brutality problem in this country may be news to some people. It wasn't particularly news to me. So, you know, the parallels that I make in the book aren't too hard to draw. The sort of obvious, if you do the research, in terms of comparing slave patrollers, who were the constables on plantations 150 years ago, they could go into any free person's house, any slave cabin, and interrogate the inhabitants to see if they had their papers, if they were there where they were supposed to be, an obvious parallel to the stop and frisk policies now. Mm. So I didn't have to do a lot of work to talk about contemporary life. It's all pretty much there in the history of slavery and how America treats its African-American citizens.
So as Cora is trying to escape and move from state to state, she's being chased by a slave catcher named Ridgway, and he catches her a couple of times. Why is he so obsessed with her? Because at one point, he still goes after her, even after her master has died.
I think a story like this needs a strong villain, and Ridgway represents a philosophy of white power that existed 150 years ago and still exists. He discusses various times imperialist ideas. If you can hold on to it, it's yours. If the red man was supposed to keep his land, he'd still have it. If the African wasn't supposed to be in shackles, he wouldn't be in shackles. So he becomes a medium, a vehicle for talking about, in a strange way, American exceptionalism, as I'm sort of interpreting it these days. And he becomes a way of exploring, critiquing, and making a conversation about different ideas of white power, in the same way that perhaps the white separatist state of North Carolina, where black people are outlawed and are killed in exhibitions recalling the heyday of lynching times in America, becomes a way of talking about another homicidal aspect of American ideas.
And Cora is most successful in this novel when she relies on herself, when she takes her fate into her own hands and acts. And she actually mans the railroad at one point and creates her own destiny. And so are you saying that it's not possible to rely on not only other people, but to rely on the kindness of white people? White people should not be trusted in this situation, that there are limits to the beneficence. Even though there are good white characters in your novel, there are limits to what they can do or to what they actually believe.
Not that so much. I mean, I think, the Underground Railroad was a collaboration between blacks and whites. So it's not as if she's being delivered solely by white people when she first escapes and in different points in the book. But she definitely starts out as an object. She's a piece of property in Georgia with no agency. And with each state she goes through, with every sort of adventure and escapade she has, she gets more and more agency. She starts making decisions for herself and becomes her own master, supplanting the master she had in Georgia. So insofar as she's relying on herself, she's becoming a person and her own force in the world, determining her own fate. Mm-hmm. Whether or not a collaboration with other white people or black people is possible, I think people can draw their own conclusions.
But there's a point where she's living in this, I guess, version of paradise, this cooperative farm run by black people, and they're free, and they're doing well, and they're happy, and, you know, they're living on borrowed time because of the surrounding communities are starting to resent their presence. So I don't want to give it all away, but there's a particularly intense scene. And it seems, you know, what you're saying is pretty bleak when it comes to the possibility of, I don't know, reconciliation or being able to live peacefully side by side.
You know, I don't think we're at a place of racial parity. I think most people would agree with that. You can listen to the rhetoric out of the Trump campaign and know that we're not in a place where racism has been eradicated in any true way. So obviously we have a long way to go. We obviously have made progress. As a parent, I hope that my kids are growing up in a better world than the one I grew up in the same way that my parents and grandparents hope the same thing for their kids and for, you know, my generation. But it's very slow.
Mm-hmm. And did you find out any much about your history, your own history, doing research for this book?
No, but it made me think more about all my nameless ancestors who died. Were they in Florida? Were they in Virginia? What part of the African coast did they come from? Did they come through Ouida the same way that Cora's grandmother came to America? My family history begins at the part of the century when my grandparents moved north. So not so much about my own history, but about the impossible facts of survival of my family and other people who made it through.
And just wondering, Cora, she spurns religion, she spurns poetry, but for some reason she really treasures the Farmer's Almanac. Why? What does that mean to her?
Well, you know, there's a big moment in most slave narratives when the slave learns how to read. You could be punished severely for learning your alphabet. If you taught your slaves, you could be beaten and fined by the government. And so there's a moment in, you know, a lot of the great slave narratives where our protagonist learns how to read for the first time. And that's obviously a moment of liberation and freedom along the way. And so it's important for Cora, as it was for many people who came out of slavery. It's finding your own voice and finding your own way into the world. And as she's hidden in the abolitionist's attic in North Carolina, here's a bunch of old almanacs stashed in there, and she makes her way through all the previous year's editions, and that's her introduction to different countries, to weather, to winter. So it's a brief moment of escape as she moves towards her true final refuge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's Colson Whitehead. He has a new book out. It's called The Underground Railroad.
Well, coming up, social media has come under fire this election. We'll talk fake news sites on Facebook, hate speech in the Twitterverse, and how the internet is changing public discourse. That's next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. While President-elect Donald Trump meets with potential cabinet officers at Trump Tower today, political analysts and a good part of the country are still taking stock of how and why Trump pulled off the win. And topping that list, the influence of social media platforms. Trump himself says Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram played key roles in his victory. Shani Jardin is here to hash this out with us. She's just the best at hashing.
Wow. I'm going to say right up front, I have no idea what is going on. I have no idea what is going
on.
And
that's saying a lot from someone who's the co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech commentator.
I have questions, but I do not yet have answers.
Well, why don't we start with fake news?
Yep.
That a lot of finger pointing going on, that fake news is what swayed the election. Why don't you run it down for us, the criticism? And how Facebook and Twitter and Google have responded to that criticism.
I can remember sitting in this very chair here at KCRW about a year ago, talking with you about the criticism from the conservative side of the country that Facebook was somehow unfair or not lending enough velocity to ultra-right-wing news sources known for trading in conspiracy theories and the like that are simply provably untrue. And they won. They won. Facebook was never set up to be a news organization. It was originally created by Mark Zuckerberg and his frat bros to rate the hotness of women on the campus. But it, over the past 10 years or so, there was this spectrum through which Facebook became the number one place that Americans look to for news. This is a thing that you can prove with numbers. And as Facebook became that essential source for so many Americans, old and young alike, along with that gradient shift, if you will, in the way that we use that technology, it became a political battleground. And it's very clear to me that Donald Trump and the campaign of people that surrounded him really understood how to exploit weaknesses in Facebook's new system, but also in other ways that we use social media. Mark Zuckerberg's comments after the election indicate that he knows that Facebook played a major role in swinging this election for Donald Trump. But the people at Facebook who are really coming out and calling it for what it is are actually a group of employees who don't feel that Zuckerberg is being direct enough and don't feel that the company is owning up to its role enough. So basically a rogue group of employees at Facebook have created a kind of
a task force.
Yeah, like
right?
A guerrilla task force within the company to address these issues because
they
feel bad about it.
But what do they want to do? And what can they do?
Well, you know, if you realize that, let's say, a piece of software or hardware that you've developed has a security weakness and that someone whose intent is not good can exploit a weakness in your application or, let's say, your phone's architecture to take over your system and cause harm, that's a common description of malware. And you could look at what these guys did in a sense as exploiting that kind of a weakness and operating kind of like malware. It's very, very effective. So I think the sensible folks that I've faved, you know, whose comments I've liked on Twitter, Facebook, and the like, are saying, yes, we can build software that can help determine for the user the reliability of a given link that's being shared. You know, JoeBob'sConspiracyTheories.com, if a human being looks through that RSS feed and determines that like 99% of what they say are alarmist and designed to evoke a response from the user, but not true, then there are ways to build systems to help people verify at a glance. I think that would have gone a long ways.
Well, we're not just talking about fake news, though. A big part of this conversation is also hate speech
right.
in social
media. Twitter made a big move against that this week.
Yes, and tell us about that.
Explosions of, you know, you can call them alt-right, but you can also call them white supremacist individuals and groups. There's been a lot of activity where there's organized harassments of individual journalists, women, black people, Jewish people, Muslim writers. There's a lot of mobbing by people who are using explicitly anti-Semitic or racist imagery about, let's say, black people that you haven't seen in the mainstream before.
And Twitter has updated its policy.
Yes, to help automate identifying some of that. But those groups, that swarm of people, they just sort of, I saw a lot of traffic last night where they were finding new ways to get around that. And I want to mention,
so it's an arms race of hate speech.
It is. But, you know, again, Twitter wasn't like, now you care about abuse. Now you care about harassment. It's a little too late.
A little too late for this election, yes, but we're going to see much more of this in future elections. And it's also affecting the faith in the media and trust in the media.
And in our institutions right now. So what I mean is that it may be too late for Twitter to undo the damage in this this cycle of who has the nuclear football. But it's not too late for us, for the people who use these platforms, to demand that they reflect the kind of society and the kind of culture of communication that we want to be part of.
And that's, we're getting to the heart of it now. And that brings us to this thing called the Overton window.
It's a fascinating term.
Yeah, which is also known as the window of discourse, which is this range of ideas that the public will accept or is acceptable in public discourse.
Yes.
And that was just blown wide open this
Absolutely.
Year. And now we have the media struggling to, for instance, describe a person like Steve Bannon,
yes.
who's just been named chief White House strategist.
Yeah. My colleague Rob Biskitza at Boing Boing created a white supremacy euphemism generator to counter what we saw as kind of dancing around the reality of people who have identified themselves essentially as white nationalists, who are now being spoken about in kind of polite terms of yore. So you can log on to boingboing.net and generate one of the kinds of contorted twists of phrase that let's say the New York Times or NBC or CNN might use to call somebody who's, you know, a former KKK member or somebody who's called for all Muslims to be placed in death camps, instead of calling them, let's say, a disenfranchised Caucasian rights advocate, you can just call them a racist. That is our point. It's just racism. It's just white supremacy. Call it what it is.
And do you also point the finger at social media for why
yes.
this is happening in 2016?
Yeah, I mean...
So what does that mean for its responsibility? I mean, explain.
Right. Well,
explain for us what responsibility social media bears for shifting this.
I'll say this to Jack Dorsey, to Mark Zuckerberg, and to all of the others who manage these communication platforms. You may not have wanted the responsibility that now lies in your lap, but it now lies in your lap. What will you do to take responsibility for the architecture and the unintended consequences of this new technology that you've built? It succeeded. And one of the great things about human innovation is that there are unintended positive consequences, but there are also unintended problems, and we don't fix them by ignoring them or pretending it's somebody else's fault.
And just really quickly, do you see this conversation heading towards a backlash against freedom of speech?
Absolutely. It's already happening. Some of my friends and colleagues are receiving anti-Semitic threats to their home addresses, threatening them individually. I mean, we have experienced harassment online. In a way, this whole political campaign is like Gamergate goes to the White House. But we have an opportunity to look at what a mess we're in and make some decisions as people and not wait around for the politicians or the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Twitters and the what have yous to fix it.
Jenny, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Barbara.
Jenny Jardin, she's co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech commentator. And that is the official Julie Myers theme music.
That's right. That's right. Get to where I am and you get a theme. I wanted to actually remind our listeners that we did a special live broadcast of Press Play last night at 7. It was about housing the homeless in Los Angeles, and a lot of really interesting ideas came up there. If you want to podcast it, just go over to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play.
Do that. It was really fantastic. And that's it for us for today. I'm Barbara Bogave. Madeline Brand will be back tomorrow, and I'll see you next time. Just stick around for To the Point coming up next here on KCRW and KCRW.com.